Welcome to episode number 68 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we'll be bringing in an expert guest, someone who's done their research or lived through it and has an interesting story from video game history to tell. My name is Kelsey Lewin. I am the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
Our guest today, once again, is video game historian and documentarian Kevin Bunch. Listeners of our show will know Kevin as the creator of the Atari Archive series of chrono gaming documentaries about the Atari 2600's library, but he's here today with a little bit of a detour to talk to us about the Fairchild Channel F, the greatest game console ever made by Fairchild. Kevin, welcome to the Video Game History Hour.
Happy to be back and talk about Fairchild.
Kevin, what is this thing? Seriously, what is a Channel F? Come on, that's not a real thing.
What's up with that name?
I wish I knew, but apparently the name did come from someone at Sears, is what I was told.
Yeah, that was new info for me. I don't know what they're doing over there at Sears, but
I'm currently trying to see if I can get confirmation on that. But no, the Channel F was the first ever programmable game console for the home. So it was the first game system that you could program a game for and then sell it on a cartridge, as opposed to something that had everything built in already.
I mean, clearly from this era, you know, the 2600 is the winner, right? And it's the one we think of, but is Channel F sort of like the alternate universe Atari?
Yeah, I think you could make that case if a few things had gone more in Fairchild's favor, which I did touch on in the video, and I'm happy to discuss further here, but needless to say, some of them were self-inflicted wounds and others just sort of fell into their lap.
So this isn't Fairchild trying to enter the video game industry at first, it's Alpex, right? So what are they doing? What is Alpex? What's going on? Why are they trying to enter the video game industry in the first place?
So Alpex Computer Corporation was based out of Connecticut. It's a lot of K sounds. And they were this little outfit, and they were working on, I believe it was like a cash register tracking software, hardware, something along those lines.
Exciting.
And to be clear, we're about 1974.
Early in the 70s. And this project was sort of falling apart on them. They needed a new source of income, basically. And so one of their staffers, a fellow named Lawrence Kirshner, went ahead and asked his boss, Norm Elpert, like, hey, what if we built a video game machine? You know, Pong is becoming popular in the arcades. This could be a hot thing. And Norm said, go for it. You know, what do we have to lose, basically? So Kirshner came up with this idea for this game system based around an Intel microprocessor, and he hired on a fellow named Lawrence Haskell. Is that right?
That's what I have in my notes as the software guy. Yes.
Wallace Kirshner and Lawrence Haskell. I always get them mixed up. So.
Ah, I thought we had two Lawrences. I was going to say, okay.
Yes. So he hired Haskell to do software. So he wrote a few games, hockey and tic-tac-toe. Very, very basic stuff. But, you know, at the time, if you didn't have a computer.
Well, so at the time that they're getting it, I mean, you mentioned Pong, right? But it's about 74. They decide, hey, let's do home video games. I mean, at this time, home video games are basically just Pong and other Pongs, right? Like things that are Pong but are called other things.
Call it tennis. Call it hockey. It's all Pong.
Yeah, at this point in time, about the only home system on the market would have been Magnavox's Odyssey, which, you know, could play a table tennis game and various other things that you slapped an overlay on the screen and pretended they were different games. And
So does this predate Pong at this point in 74?
It doesn't predate Pong the arcade game, but it predates the home game. Yeah.
Got it. Okay, so this is kind of a radical idea then. I mean, it's not like, hey, we're seeing success from this home video game industry. Let's try our own, right? This is like, there is a home video game. We could also do one of those.
Yeah, there is a home video game, and it's selling okay. You know, it's not really a huge moneymaker for Magnavox, but it's there.
But well, I guess my question right, that's what I'm getting at is, like, do we know, like, this seems like a crazy idea, like, where's this coming from,
especially when they're like, hey, we're not doing so well, this project is falling apart. Right. Let's enter this market that doesn't really exist yet as a way of saving ourselves.
Are these like time travelers?
You know, the idea of looking at microprocessors and thinking, okay, I can make a game out of this, right? That was fairly early. I mean, even going back to computers in the 50s and 60s, when something had that kind of processing power, there would inevitably be somebody who'd say, oh, I wonder if I can make this play blackjack or something.
Right.
So
yeah. This is okay. So
this is sort LPEC of in sort that of line.
Has access to these parts, right? Like, they might have, I don't know, maybe you know, but maybe they have excess inventory. They're trying to figure out what to do with something like that. Essentially, like, they're like, okay, what else can we do with the knowledge that we have and the parts that we can source? And games just sort of seems to be an obvious, not obvious, but a logical answer, right?
Yeah, and it's a fairly common attitude I've kind of noticed in some of these early game systems, is that people looked at this as a new market for microprocessors and sort of a way to help Trojan horse people to become a little more familiar with computer technology. And I don't know if that was the case specifically for LPEX's project, but I wouldn't be shocked if that was somewhere in their thought process.
All right, so these two gentlemen work on essentially, you know, prototyping this system. You gave us the resolution in there, which is a very funny 128x64 resolution, sort of a double wide. So, you know, at this point, what they're sort of developing in-house a hardware product with the thinking that, like, we could sell this to a distributor, sort of thing.
Yeah, they recognized that this was going to be way too much of an effort or too much of a lift for them as just this little computer corporation. They didn't really make consumer products, as far as I'm aware. So they started looking around at who they could partner with that could send this out. And they talked to a bunch of TV manufacturers, is my understanding. And none of them were
interested. That's the entire video game industry is through TV manufacturers. So yeah,
right,
that's where you
Magnavox. They're like, yeah, of course, we'll go with them first.
So how do they start getting in with Fairchild? How does that relationship start?
My understanding is that they ran out of TV manufacturers to talk to. So they thought, well, this is using, you know, semiconductor parts, using a microprocessor. Let's talk to semiconductor companies. And Fairchild was interested in this because one of their people had just constructed his own arcade machine just to sort of show that you could do that with their microprocessor in-house. And that would be Jerry Lawson.
So I was about to say, if anyone knows anything about the Fairchild Channel F, and this is probably the extent of my knowledge before watching your video, it's that Jerry Lawson worked on it. And he is, first of all, one of the earliest African Americans in the video game industry, and he's recognized for that. But second of all, he's recognized essentially as creating the ROM cartridge, the interchangeable programmable ROM cartridge as a concept for changing video games. I mean, is that does that come from him, or is that something that you know the LPEX guys come in with? I mean, like kind
did
of
that
take
exist
us
in
there.
The prototype, I think, right, is what you're trying to ask.
I believe the LPEX cartridge or LPEX cartridge, the LPEX system, the idea was that you could change your games out, and I believe the prototype used just sort of like PROM cards that you could pop out and plug in.
So sort of Odyssey style, where there's no additional software that you're plugging in. It's more like sort of rearranging the hardware.
Well, no, they were still programming the games, but that was just where they kept the ROM chips themselves, were on these little cards, and you'd plug them in and out. But as far as making that into a retail product, there would be a lot of work that would have to go in, because those cards are easy to break. Like, if anyone's handled a circuit board before. They're tougher than you'd think, but they're also fairly fragile and easy to snap.
Yeah, and you don't want to just hand a circuit board to a consumer. That's not an appealing looking product, nor is it a safe product, yeah, and probably.
And especially consumers who have no concept of how to handle these things or how sensitive they are, or whether or not, you know, do we have to keep this in the system while after the game's loaded up, that sort of thing. So those are all issues that Lawson's team had to resolve. And my impression is he was not directly hands-on with the cartridge design itself. He was sort of the overseeing person of that, and he had a lot of hands-on with the design of the retail version of the Alpex game system.
It's like how we credit like Gunpei Okoi for making the Game Boy. It's like, well, it was his team. Like, he had a lot to do with it, but there's no like singular creator of the Game Boy. And this situation strikes me as similar, where it took a lot of different people coming together to actually execute this idea. And it's his team, and he should absolutely be credited for that. I do want to back up just a moment, though, because Frank, you mentioned it, but I want to make sure it's really clear. The Odyssey is out at this time, and the Odyssey has cartridges. So what is different? Can you explain the difference between a programmable cartridge and like what the Odyssey is doing?
Sure. So the Odyssey, everything is just hard design. It's all off the shelf parts. And all the cards are doing are completing the circuit. And depending on how the circuitry is laid out on the card, you get a different game, sort of. You know, functionally, you're using a few different squares and a vertical line for all of these games. So there's only so much you can do with that, but that's the long and the short of it. With a programmable system like the Channel F or the Atari 2600, there's a microprocessor in there, and you are developing a game by programming it into software, and then you're burning that to a ROM chip or whatever and popping that into the cartridge, and then you can plug that into the system and you can run it, which means that with the Odyssey, there's only so many types of games you can do, because there's only so many layouts of circuits that you can really come up with. But with the Channel F or the Atari or what have you, the NES, you're really limited by, you know, what can the system itself pull off, or what can you shove into a cartridge to make the system pull off, which they also took advantage with the Channel F a couple times. They had a few extra RAM carts that were able to do things that the base system couldn't. So that's sort of the
expansion. Wow.
Yeah, RAM expansion. So that's sort of the key difference there. I don't know if that explained it well, but
no, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's important to sort of step back for a second and recognize this as an innovation and something that's kind of crazy, because it's like the video game market at this point is really only just the Odyssey. And, you know, while the Channel F, I think it's fair to say, is forgotten today, as this, like, you know, Fairchild Corporation, like everything here is sort of forgotten today. But really, like, this is a new idea at this time to have programmable game cartridges, to be able to have one system with, you know, theoretically infinite game possibilities, and I think that's sort of where we put Fairchild in our sort of history canon, right? Is like they innovated on this thing
when this is like stayed the way that the video game industry works ever since. I mean, like, the concept of creating a base console, a base system that you can then develop all kinds of different things for that work with that, as opposed to, you know, buying this home Pong system for $100 and then this home Pong system that looks a little different and is maybe called tennis or whatever for a different $100. I mean, it's like, this is how the video game industry still works. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And one thing I noticed when I was doing research for this project is that you look into some of these really early trade magazines, and even as early as 1975, when the Pong boom kind of started at home with Atari's Pong and Magnavox's Odyssey follow-ups and whatnot, they were already talking about programmables, and Atari was already researching it themselves, and other companies were looking into it, like Magnavox and RCA and a few weird ones like First Dimension. Like, who's even heard of them today? But they were apparently looking into their own microprocessor machine.
Well, it's obviously so much more economical than developing entire systems from scratch every time. So it's maybe an inevitability of the industry, like almost definitely, but I don't know. There's something to be said for doing it first.
Yeah, they managed to get this out the door before anyone else, and several of the people who claimed that they were building them just never got off the ground for various reasons. So, you know, kudos to Fairchild for sticking it out and actually making a product that people wanted, and people did want it.
And God, they had a lot of problems getting this thing out.
Yes. Yes,
they did. But before we get there, I think it's worth explaining the system itself in a little more. So, I mean, well, for example, while we're talking about the carts, if you're making cartridges, it's like, what are you looking at for inspiration, right? Like what is the shape of a cartridge? And well, you tell us, Kevin, what were they looking at?
They looked at 8-tracks because they recognized that these were something that most people had experience with, and they seemed reasonably durable. I think that last point could be debated a little bit based on how 8-tracks played out. But
where did the 8-track design come from?
Whoa.
the rabbit hole. I'm going to blame it on you, Matic.
And then the cartridges... unlike, say, an NES cartridge, there was sort of a mechanism on the bottom to keep the pins from being exposed, right? Much like the Atari.
Yeah, God, I have a few on the shelf. I should have just grabbed one as a visual aid. But the idea here is that there's a cover on the Channel F cartridge that keeps the pins protected. And when you slide it into the cartridge slot, there's a sort of a catch there that will pull the thing down and expose the pins, and it'll lock it into place. And the only way to get that back out is to push the eject button. That way people couldn't accidentally yank the cartridge out and damage the system or the cartridge, because they were very worried that people would do that and fry the thing.
Well, and no one knows not to do that yet.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, you can put that in the instruction manual, but once people know how to hook it up, how much further are they going to read? The interesting thing here is, like, the lock on the mechanism, you can't really open it unless you really try. Like, you have to actively fuss with the shell to get that to open up outside of the console itself. So it might be a little over-designed, but I feel at the time it was probably the right call.
Atari carts are like this too, which we've struggled with several times, and opening those cartridges sucks, but it's not like, it's more than just Atari was like, hey, that's a good idea, we're going to use that. There were like employees that defected to Atari, right? And
yeah.
Basically took that design.
Yeah, there was a fellow who was working on the Channel F cartridges, Doug Hardy. He was working with Ron Smith and Nick Tales4 and all this stuff. And Hardy decided to jump ship to Atari because... at the time, Silicon Valley was very insular. People hopped around between companies all the time. So this wasn't really unexpected. And he helped them design a cartridge that had a similar sort of mechanism, but wouldn't infringe on the Fairchild patent. So they would be in the clear. And I imagine Atari actively headhunted him. Once they knew he was looking for a job.
Where else are you going to look for this position, right? The one person who's ever done it. Yeah.
And, he to his credit, like, he seems to have been the guy for Atari, whereas he was just part of a group of people for Fairchild. So I'd say he definitely took a step up there.
So something else about the Channel F that's very distinctive is its controller. And again, let's remember there's no home joystick at this point. There, like, we don't know what a game controller is. So, describe to us this this fairly odd controller that the Channel F employed.
Okay, so imagine you're holding a stick, like a handle, however you want to think of it, and then there's just this triangular shaped knob on top. And the knob you can push in eight directions like a joystick. So far, so good.
Well, except the triangle part. Why is it a triangle?
You know, it's a little more comfortable to hold, I guess.
Okay, all right.
And then you can push it down and pull it up. So there's two more functions in there. Like the knob itself, you're pushing and pulling up like a plunger.
I actually didn't know you could pull it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a pull mechanic there. And then you can also twist it 45 degrees clockwise and counterclockwise. So those are all the functions on this.
It's like an air pump. Like, it has the same kind. I mean, you don't have the same range of motion as an air pump. Obviously, you're not going all the way up and down. But, like, it's a thing on a stick that you can move in whatever direction you want and up and down.
It's kind of a clever design, given that apparently the Elpex prototype just had, like, a series of weird key layouts that was really uncomfortable to handle.
It's a good design other than firing while moving. It's not really a thing. I mean, you sort of can. And they did address this later.
And I guess I should note that after the video came out, I did manage to talk to someone else who worked at Fairchild, because of course that's how it always goes.
That's how it goes, everyone.
Yep.
Yep.
Never publish.
As we said in our episode with Norm, I believe, never publish anything.
The only safe way.
Yep. Yep.
So 2 days ago, I interviewed a fellow who was the director of marketing at Fairchild for the Channel F called, his name was John Donatoni. And he explained that...
Wait, John Donatoni?
Yes.
That's such a good... Donatoni.
It's a very cool
name. Like Donut and Tony? Cool.
Yeah, yeah. But he explained that the controller was actually a big failure point for them. Like, they expected to get a certain amount of systems back as returns, because, of course, you're going to have quality issues no matter what. But they had a lot more than they were expecting, and the controller was the failure point. Like... And he said that they tweaked it internally a few times, but no matter what they tried, it kept being an issue. And that
Well, come on, that stick does so much. Like, yeah, I think even today, like, you'd have a hard time designing that thing.
Yeah, I really am impressed that they designed this thing and thought, okay, yeah, that can stand up to all these people. They over-designed the heck out of the cartridge slot. But to the controller, it's like, well, even using one now, it just feels a little like, am I going to break this thing? And apparently people were.
So tell us about the games for this thing. Like, what kind of games are being made for this? And what are they kind of thinking about when they're developing games for it?
So a lot of the games for this, they looked to arcades, which of course they did. Everyone was doing that exact same thing. So you've got like your... Tank clone Desert Fox. You've got Spitfire, which is based on the arcade game Spitfire and was written by the exact same person. And he just said, well, screw it, I'm going to reuse my exact same game concept. That guy was apparently a real character. You had like a Seawolf kind of clone. Seawolf.
What is Seawolf?
Oh, it's a Midway game where you're sort of a submarine shooting at ships.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess I could clarify that. And I guess Spitfire, for clarification, because no one has heard of Spitfire, it's a dogfighting game. And the Channel F version is kind of interesting because it's got an AI opponent that sort of adjusts its difficulty based on how well you're doing. Like, it'll get more aggressive or less aggressive depending on if you're... doing well or not.
And that's interesting because it's not a thing yet, right?
Yeah, certainly not in the home.
Visually, you know, there's not like graphics as you might think of them. If you're trying to imagine this at home, right? Like there's sort of arrangements of tile, not tiles, of
they're very pixels. Chunky pixels.
Very chunky pixels. Most games are sort of more iconographic, I guess, than visual, I would say, right? Like there's and tends to be sort of a lot of them tend to be like one solid color on top of a colored background sort of thing, and with some exceptions.
Yeah, this thing had like a 16 color palette, so you really didn't have a lot of choices. And I guess beyond arcade games, they looked to other activities that they figured people might want to play. Like there's a blackjack game, which apparently was one of their hot sellers. Blackjack was really having a moment, I guess, in the late 70s. There's word games and memory games. A version of Nim on there, which, a go-to for early computers right there. So just a real real smorgasbord of late 70s game design go-tos.
All right, so how does this thing get to market?
So this thing debuted publicly at the summer CES show in 1976. And it made a huge splash because no one had really seen anything like this. They were the only company really showing off anything of this sort.
Do we know if the VCS, the Atari, is in development at this point?
The VCS is in development at this point. Atari has not said anything publicly about it. And they won't until the following summer CES for legal reasons. Which is to say they had an agreement with Magnavox that anything they showed publicly in the video game home space before like June 1st, 77, they had to share, and they didn't want to share it with Magnavox. Mm. So they waited 3 days afterwards to show it.
So this is really exciting. Cause this is the first time you see like a really competent looking home console. And I mean, it sounds like people are excited about it. Retailers are excited about it, but no one remembers the Fairchild or the Channel F. So, what happened?
So Donatoni, when I talked to him, said that this was a really hot item. Like they had a lot of orders for it after showing it off at CES, as you would expect. And they were expecting to get this out around September of 76, make around 200, 250,000 units, sell through those for the year. And then starting early in 77, they would begin putting out new cartridges and new games, because at this point video game home market very seasonal. You'd get new stock in at the end of the year around Christmas time, and then once that was done, that was it until next fall. And their big pitch to retailers was like, look, this is programmable, this has new games on cartridges, we don't have to just sell these at Christmas time, we can sell them year round. So that was a big deal. The first problem for Fairchild was that they had to get this approved through the U.S. regulatory body, the FCC. And that's where a lot of the problems began.
A lot of the problems that they had to solve for everyone else, essentially, that would come after.
Yes. So the FCC had recently adopted rules around things that you plugged into your TV, pretty much. So, tape players and camcorders and video games. And they were very stringent because, they didn't know, okay, well, we don't want these things to be emitting a lot of radio frequency radiation because that'll mess up signals in other people's TVs or radios or what have you. And so, Fairchild kind of took this on the nose. Since they were not really a consumer company up to this point, they were making semiconductor parts. This and digital watches were sort of their big go-tos in the consumer world. So they didn't really have a lab for testing out these kinds of emissions. And as a result, they took this to the FCC. The FCC did their tests and said, this thing has failed miserably. You need to tweak it or you can't get it to market. So that was in August, which means that they were already going to miss the September market shipping date. So their staff just had to hurry up and try and figure this one out.
Yeah, so I mean, how do they even try to start reducing RF emissions here? Like what are the things they have to start adding or chopping off or whatever to make this thing pass regulation?
So Lawson had the idea of cutting down the controller cable lengths, because originally they were 8 feet long. And if you see a retail original Channel F unit, they're more like 3 feet tops, 2 feet probably. One of their tests at the FCC was like, okay, well, if you coil up these cables, suddenly they're sort of functioning as an antenna, and that messes up other things. So he had the idea to cut that off. So they did that. Will Alexander and Rich Olney were the two people sort of tasked at Fairchild with reducing these emissions. They had to work in the dead of night because Fairchild did not have its own, you know, shielded lab, which meant that they could only work on this when everyone else was out of the building and when there were no FM radio transmissions going on. So that way they could get like a clean test signal. And, you know, one of the big issues they had was that all the transistor logic chips on the board, like 40 of them, like they were spiking emissions. The microprocessors and everything else, those were fine. It was just this. And they were trying on, they were working on this for like a month and a half before finally Fairchild's management was like, look, we got to get this out the door for the Christmas season, bringing in some consultants. And their idea was just slab the whole thing in metal. So that'll shield all the emissions. It'll be fine. And it worked, but it also drove up the cost. So all of a sudden your system is $20 more expensive, which once you're getting into large numbers, really adds up.
Well, and heavier to ship.
And heavier to ship, yeah.
And it's the 70s, so that $20 is more like $60 or whatever. I mean, it's, yeah, you have to all of a sudden like shove a bunch of metal in your system to make it pass these regulations. And you're delayed, and you're missing your target. So, I mean, what happens when it makes it to market?
So it finally gets clearance in October, and it finally starts making it to stores in November, according to Donatoni again. He said that the demand was so hot for it at first that this didn't really impact them much at first. Like, retailers were just happy to get it. So they ended up shipping around 50, 60,000 units is the estimates I've seen at the time, which is a far cry fewer than what they were intending, but it's what they managed to get. And they got three cartridges out, which was the plan, but two of them didn't get out until like right before Christmas.
Ugh.
Yeah, not ideal, but that was the situation. Apparently they sold through all of their stock, so they were very happy about this.
Right, but now you've missed the holiday season for, like, you sell all of the things, right? So if you only have 50,000 to sell, that you're kind of done till next Christmas, right? I mean, not literally, but that's what's going on in this industry so far, right?
In general, yes. They did continue shipping and selling new stuff through the first part of the new year. Video game sales were not particularly hot the first half of 77, because, you know, again, retailers were expecting this to be seasonal and they weren't going to devote that much shelf space to something that they weren't sure about. So like they put out a few cartridges earlier in the year and some pretty good ones like Spitfire. There was Lawson's Space War game, which as far as I'm aware was the only one he wrote himself. But he talked about that in one of his depositions up at the Strong Museum of Play in his papers. He's like, yeah, I wrote the Space War game.
So we're in 1977,
yep.
Which, you know, for those who look at the sort of Wikipedia timeline of video game history, we know it's coming that Christmas, which is the Atari VCS. So they, you know, they're aware, at least by summer CES, that this is coming. Like, are mm-hmm. they prepared to go to war?
You know, it's funny because you would think they would be, but Fairchild was very much not really, I don't think they were paying that close attention to what other people were doing in the market at this point, because their house was kind of on fire at the time. Basically,
tell us about that. What happened? Yeah.
So Fairchild had the digital watch market as well. It wasn't just you know, the video games. This was sort of this LCD watches. You could push a button, it would light up. Super cool and fad worthy in the mid 70s. And they sort of were one of the pioneers of this. And they had like high end and mid range and low end markets. Problem is that suddenly everyone else started jumping into this, including actual watch makers who could undercut them because they had more money and better production lines. So all of a sudden they couldn't really compete on price so much. And then they also started having quality control issues with their watches, as I was informed 2 days ago. So they got a lot of returns on those, which meant retailers stopped ordering so many because they didn't want to have to deal with that. And as a result, they lost millions in dollars just in the first half of the year, and even more over the course of 77. So the Fairchild president, Wilf Corrigan, he was like, OK, look, we got to play this a little more conservatively. We're going to limit our production numbers here. The other bit of weirdness that I learned, you know, again, after the video came out, is that Fairchild's production system for stock was not set up for retail. It was set up for a semiconductor business. So the big difference is there is that you get orders, you know, they pay you, you make exactly that many things, and they get them a couple months down the line. The issue they were having with the video games here and with watches is that stores don't operate like that. Stores were putting in their orders and then they were like, hey, it's been, when can you get me these cartridges? Oh, 3 months? Well, I need them now. This is when I have the money in my budget for it. So that also kind of impacted their production lines, I imagine, because, you know, they could just, these people could just go to Atari and Atari be like, oh, hey, we can fill your orders immediately.
Right. So between, you know, the sort of not being prepared to manufacture for retail, but then also being conservative, I would assume, with even manufacturing ahead of time, even if they had, you know, even if they were on top of the needs of retailers, they're also not investing in manufacturing as many units as they could because they're sort of in trouble. And, you know, it seems like that kind of opened the doors for Atari to come in and essentially destroy them. And it's, you know, it's difficult not to do a sort of what if here, but also at the same time, I think that most would agree that even the launch titles for the 2600 just like they look far more fun than the Channel F.
Yeah, it's funny because it's a lot of the same games between the two, but the way the Atari hardware is set up, the games just sort of move more smoothly and play more smoothly. Plus they had, you know, their different controllers, and the 2600 had a few other technical advantages over the Channel F, like the original Channel F design. The audio came out of a speaker on the system, which not only sounds real grating, but was expensive, like you had to put a whole speaker in your system. The Channel F uses like a frame buffer, which means a lot of memory has to go into that. Whereas the Atari, you're just drawing everything line by line, which is a pain for programmers, but gives them a lot more flexibility in what they want to do, which is also why Atari games started looking so much better, so much quicker than Channel F games. And, you know, I remember listening to this Classic Gaming Expo keynote about the Channel F that Jerry Lawson and Rick Maurer did. And Rick Maurer worked at Fairchild and then moved to Atari after Fairchild was laying off a bunch of people. And he said that the 2600 was so much easier to program for. And if someone is telling you the 2600 is easier to program for, then your system is probably a nightmare.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Oh God.
Yeah. So, you know, I have a soft spot for the Channel F and it's got some really cool, like, exclusive games, but my God, it's very of its time.
So, I mean, you know, it's not like it immediately dies or anything. They head into 78. They're, you know, suddenly they have very real competition. Does this thing just sort of slowly bleed out and die, or do they, you know, keep introducing new products? Like what happens now at this point, now that they're, you know, not the first programmable game card, not the only programmable game cartridge system out there?
So internally, my impression is that everyone sort of knew the writing was on the wall, also because a bunch of people got laid off because Fairchild was hemorrhaging money. Eventually, they just cut their entire Time Products division entirely, just to staunch the bleeding. But with the Channel F, they kept putting out a few new games. They were working on a redesign of the hardware. They'd already done a sort of a board level revision in 77 to get rid of all the TTL parts, consolidate them into a couple custom chips. My favorite part of that is that apparently that was specifically to compete with the RCA Studio 2, which sold even fewer units than the Channel F. But the new unit, it had removable controllers, which frankly they should have had from the get-go. And Nicholas Tailsfor, one of the hardware designers, has said as much to me. He said that, you know, they wanted to have removable controllers on the original design, and frankly, it probably would have worked out better for them, but it, quote-unquote, cost too much money. But the new Model 2 unit Channel F had all these fancy accoutrements. They were planning a keyboard attachment for it for some reason.
Of course, everyone did.
Well, yeah, this is like a keypad attachment, though, right? Not like a full...
Yeah, it's
keyboard?
Not a full keyboard. It's just, if you've ever seen the Atari keypads that are just like, 12 buttons or whatever, it's sort of like that. This never came out. Apparently, they never really got that far along on the project. But, you know, they announced it. They showed off mock-ups of it. So that was definitely in their view sites. They were thinking of other uses for Channel F, like... the whole TV POW idea that I go over in the video.
I want to pause on that real quick because it's a very fun, interesting idea. Tell us about TV POW.
TV POW, the concept here came from a game show host down in Florida named Marvin Kepner. And his idea was that, he got it from some radio DJs, but the idea was that you would hook up a video game system into a TV line, more or less, and then it would be on the TV, and someone could call in, and then they would shout in the phone line, POW, and it would make something happen on the screen. And their idea here with the Channel F was that you'd have it with the shooting gallery game, so every time someone said POW, it would fire a bullet.
So you would remotely control a TV in a game show, or control like a game on the TV in this game show by yelling.
Yeah, yes. If you were the lucky, you know, the lucky winner of who got to control what was being broadcast on TV at that moment. Yeah.
Is there no concept of lag back? Like, did they not understand that things take time? Like, it's fascinating to me that this idea got any further than an idea, because surely they had to understand even back then that, like, those things aren't instant. You don't see the TV. You don't broadcast the TV and like respond to what you're seeing on the broadcast, and then that travels through the phone and back in no time. Like that.
Marketing and product people have a remarkable way of not understanding how things work, and I'm pretty sure that is the entire explanation behind TV POW.
So it's really funny to me because, yeah, there is lag there. These were all being made for like local TV stations, so it probably wasn't as awful as it could have been. So they tried to engineer around it, if you will. They had some folks working on this, and the first big challenge was that the Channel F is not NTSC spec. So it did not play nicely with the TV signals that they were trying to broadcast. So they took it out to their test location, TV station. Didn't work. Evidently, they figured that out eventually. But then they discovered that their setup to hear the person saying POW took too long to respond, like a few seconds, basically. And their workaround was just genius, because their workaround was just having someone on the other line physically pushing the button whenever they heard the person say pow. Which is
so
just...
They just completely faked it because the technology was impossible.
Yeah, it's the perfect kludge solution to me. It's like, you know, whatever. Throw up your hands. This is much easier.
Was all of the software on TV POW just home software, or did they write unique programs for this?
As far as I'm aware, Fairchild side of things, anyway, it was unique software. I know eventually TV POW moved over to the Intellivision, because it was an existing system at the time. And I'm pretty sure that used specialized software. No one was playing a space battle and manually yelling in to move the ships around or whatever.
It, boy, this is very reminiscent of what I believe was the episode right before this with Norm, the gaming historian, where we talked about the Konami, what was it called?
The laser scope.
The laser scope, where you looked at your TV and yelled pow. Oh, actually, you yelled fire.
Yelled fire.
Well, yeah. you could yell pow.
Yeah, you could yell pow.
Everything old is new again, you know?
Yeah.
And we got onto the Kinect, and it's voice activated controls.
Well, and then TV POW is essentially cloud gaming.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So that's
it is. I'll argue that. You talked a little bit in the documentary about the chess game and its significance in the Channel F story.
Yeah, so this is the big regional exclusive retail release for the Channel F. I think there are a couple other like little pieces of German software that had very specific uses, like learning to drive and that sort of thing. But this actually made it to retail. This was something you could go to a West German store and buy. And this, my understanding of this all came from some old Jerry Lawson interviews that he did back in the 2000s before he died. And the idea here was that they were licensing out the Channel F to manufacturers in Europe, basically. And different countries would have different manufacturers, and they'd make their own version of the Channel F. And the one in Germany, Saba, really wanted a chess game, because home chess games were all the rage. And they thought, well, hey, if we have this, maybe we can sell more of these Channel Fs, which reportedly were not hot items in Germany at the time. So the folks at Fairchild put together a chess game. It used a little bit of extra RAM. It had a little light on the cartridge that would light up whenever the computer was thinking, so you wouldn't think that the game had just locked up while it sits there for like 2 or 3 minutes.
And, I like that. That's a good way of like showing that, hey, things are happening here.
Yeah, like I'm thinking of early Famicom like Go games that, you know, will pause for a while but just display the text thinking.
Yeah.
You know? So it is really smart.
This is a good way to do that without having to use, you know, memory space to write anything on the screen or make a little sound effect or whatever.
The other thing that comes to mind for me is that, Kevin, I think you know this, and Kelsey, I think I just taught you this, that the sign that your boxed VCS Atari 2600 console is from the first run is that there is a chess icon on the box. For a proposed chess game that didn't happen. So Channel F does what Atari don't. At least in Germany.
Yeah. I mean, Atari eventually got their chess game in like 79, and apparently it was a whole to-do.
Mm-hmm, I'm sure.
Because someone was like, hey, why did we put this chess piece on the box when we're not going to do anything with it? And like, well, you can't make a chess game on this system. It's too weak. And they found a way.
Yeah, I didn't have a light, I bet, on the
It didn't. Right. It just flashed a bunch of random colors on the screen and looked really bad in the process.
So, all right, how does it die? You know, like eventually all things die. And it doesn't seem like this lasts too long. So, you know, does this sort of just bleed out, or does it gets
shot to die twice, or... you know?
Okay. All right. All right. Let's hear it.
So 1978 was not a great year for the home game market. The dedicated market pretty much just was dead except for the very low end toy aisle stuff. Retailers were kind of wary of the whole programmable things because they didn't get as hot of sales as they were expecting in 77, which is pretty funny because Fairchild and Atari both sold out their runs. It was only RCA that didn't, so I don't know what was going on there. But so they purposely didn't order that many units for 78, which Atari took a hit on because they overproduced, and Fairchild didn't take that hit because they were being conservative with their productions, but they were in rough shape already. So, you know, after the returns came in from 78 and how the market did around Christmas, basically the Fairchild management just looked at it and said, you know, this market's flat. It's not looking to be any better in 79. We're just going to get out of this whole thing entirely. And they sold it all off to Zircon, the same people that would eventually bring you the Stud Finder and a million dad jokes.
Wait, is that their, like, their trademark is Stud Finder?
That is their big product even today.
Wow.
Like you can go to a Home Depot and buy a Stud Finder to find the studs.
I love the weird old video game days where it's like Emerson. Like, I think of them as making toasters and the Arcadia.
Yeah, Emerson had its hands in a lot of weird stuff. God, that would be a nightmare to research further.
Well, before there's a video game industry, it's just like, I don't know, who works with electrical components sometimes? You know, like, it's just, it's anyone who deals in electricity, it seems like.
Yeah, and, you know, they were throwing microprocessors in everything in 78, 79. Like,
right.
Appliances had microprocessors. The board games were getting microprocessors. You get your electronic talking battleship or whatever. You had handheld games like the little Mattel Electronics ones and the Microvision. So
Simon Says.
Yeah, Simon, this is sort of where the retailers were looking to. They didn't think TV games were going to be a huge thing going forward, and I can understand why. So they were looking at other opportunities. So Zircon took the Channel F stuff and they started clearing it out. And then 1980 comes along. Space Invaders is a huge hit for Atari. It's selling, you know, as many 2600s that year as they had sold in the previous three. So I think that sort of sparked the thinking at Zircon to put out some new Channel F games. And by new, I mean old stock of games that just had never gone out, or just new copies of games that never went out. It's a little unclear because it's hard to find anyone who worked on this at Zircon that's still alive. But yeah, they did put out an announcement in August 1980 that they had these new games available, and evidently those did well enough for them that in 81 they put out two more games, and apparently those did not do as well for them, because after that is when they just sort of let the Channel F peter out.
Okay, but this thing sold for 6 years.
Yeah.
Like, that's, I don't know, that's kind of remarkable for a system that I think of as just like before I watched this video, I knew the Channel F existed. I often confused it with the Bally Astrocade, which is kind of funny considering who I'm talking to right now. and it's, but, you know, I knew it existed. And my assumption was Wild West days, it comes out, it just flops, and they move on to do something else. But it's like, no, this lasted 6 years. Maybe it wasn't an awesome 6 years. But, I mean, Zircon's putting out new games. They're still supporting this thing. It's not like they're just selling through inventory. Like, they're continuing, I would assume, even to manufacture the thing. And it's, I don't know, I guess... Well, maybe this is a question. Have we given the Channel F a fair shake, or is it just a blip that's, you know, not worth really discussing other than its contributions to its firsts?
God, Zircon even commissioned a new controller that had like a button on it.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah,
like makes a proper it possible button. To play these.
So, you know, they I don't know how much support they were giving. They were giving it some support. Yeah, it's funny. It's hard to say that it's not gotten a fair shake. I think you could argue that people look at it as worse than it is. It's a very 70s game system. A lot of the games have not aged all that great. And I know this because I played all of them. And some of them are pretty rough. But
you play every 2600 game, so you're the right judge.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll say this. They're comparable to a lot of what Atari was putting out in the 70s.
Am I mistaken in that? I thought I remember, like, the magazine Electronic Games, like Bill Kunkel and Arnie Katz, like I thought they liked the Fairchild F more than they liked the VCS, like for a while.
I remember
maybe that was just a blog post I read for one of them or something a long time ago, but I remember that being a thing that, like, you know, not that game journalism really existed yet because they were the first, but I don't know, like it wasn't a bad system. It just wasn't selling very much, right?
Yeah, you know, I remember that they did a column about some of the later Channel F games, and they're like, these are really good, guys. Like, hey, Zircon's doing pretty well putting these out. And, you know, of course, apparently no one bought them because the system was gone like the next year. But, you know, they were real thrilled about it. And, yeah, you know, I think it's a pretty decent little thing. You know, it didn't get the lifespan of the Atari, and it doesn't get the aftermarket support of the Atari. But the stuff that's on there aftermarket is pretty impressive. Like the guys who ported Pac-Man to the thing, like it even has the intermissions and all these animations, and it's an impressive piece of work. And just looking at this on 76 hardware based on 74 hardware, and you can't help but feel a little impressed by it.
The Channel F, the little console that sort of could. So before we wrap this up, I think something worth talking about with this video is the research that you did that went into it. Clearly, and I believe you even mentioned this, a lot of this was done at the Strong Museum of Place library, specifically with the Jerry Lawson papers. I don't imagine that there's too much else there relevant, but you were citing some, you know, publications that I've definitely never heard of, like from the 70s. Like I mean, I don't even know what the question is, other than like how. Like how do you go about researching the Channel F? Where do you start?
So the Lawson papers were a good start. He had some internal Fairchild documents, some court depositions that he did later on, and like Alpex v. Parker Brothers, I think, was one, and like a Nintendo lawsuit of some sort. And he had some clippings from some coverage from Electronic News and Business Week and Black Enterprise that were related to his career and the Channel F itself. Beyond that, I had to get a little creative. So I had to go through the panel appearances from Jerry Lawson from when he was retired and there was interest in Fairchild again. So, you know, VCF, the Classic Gaming Expo, those sorts of things. Ben Jedward's interviewed Jerry Lawson and a bunch of the other folks from Alpex a while back, so, you know, he was able to provide me with a little bit of help too. He even sent over Gene Landrum's original report to Fairchild, saying, hey, we should get into the video game market, here's this kind of money we could make in it. So I was able to pull from that. And then some of the weird publications, the trades, like, so Electronic Engineering Times and Electronic News, those aren't really online.
Nope.
And there's not really any archives that have full runs of them. But I found a few when I was going through Hagley Museum's RCA papers. their engineer Joe Weisbecker worked on their video game system, so he kept basically any mention that included it, which included a few about the Channel F. So I was able to pull from those, and those actually spurned a few last-minute rewrites of my script. There was Weekly Television Digest, which also doesn't exist online, but there's a few...
Nothing does.
Yeah, there's a few enterprising game researchers, friend of the show, Ethan Johnson, and a couple of folks
that
who
is
are
his title. Yeah.
Yep. And a couple of folks who are working on a Mattel Electronics book that I think is supposed to come out this year. But they're like academics out in California, and they had access to a bunch of them that he didn't. So they also sent over what they had to me a while back. So I finally went through and sifted through all of that. And I was able to get a few pieces from Merchandising, which is a retail trade publication that ran in the 70s and 80s. And it's all collected right here at the Library of Congress. So I was able to just sort of pop over there and sift through it a while back. So I've been working on this for a while. And then I interviewed a bunch of people that I could find. That was one thing that I got out of the Jerry Lawson papers, is that in his memos, he had all these people named as going to these copies. And I was able to track down a few of them and interview them. And they had a lot of really interesting stories to tell about the Channel F.
Well, and that's, you know, that's one of the hardest things, is just finding names sometimes, right? And
it's not like there's credits on the box or whatever, you know?
Well, and these engineers from the 70s, not super popular on LinkedIn, you know, like it's not really, they don't go and expose, you know, their history there. They don't have like online portfolios or something. And I mean, we're talking about like 70s engineers. Like we're, you know, Kelsey, you and I have trouble finding like 90s game publisher producer names, you know, like that aren't in game credits or whatever. And you know, like one of my favorite resources that we have, and we only have like three of them, are show guidebooks for the Consumer Electronics Show, because it's like, here's the exhibitor, here's five contact names for the exhibitor. It's like, okay, this is like, we finally know a name of someone who worked at like Vic Tokai in the US, you know, like this is the only source for this info. And not that anyone listening has these, but man, I
don't know. Maybe you do.
Maybe you do. But eBay wise, like... I have all the CES searches I could ever have. And I have for many years, probably like 10 at this point. I have bought every guidebook, which equals I said maybe three, but it's more like maybe seven that we have at this point. But it's like, God, just
hear that, everyone.
Where are these?
Give Kelsey and Frank all your CES books.
All the CES guidebooks.
Did you work, or like your parents or someone work in a consumer electronics business back then? And did they go, yeah, just, man, now that I'm thinking about that, I'm like, some of the people I've talked to who are very like game adjacent, but probably attended those shows, I'm like, maybe that should just be a standard question I ask everybody. Do you keep any of your consumer electronics?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think Kelsey, you and I have been talking about just hunkering down a little more with just like contacting people. It's very hard work. And, you know, I do think we should maybe have like a standard, like, okay, start asking them about this stuff, like list, you know, like, did you take photos? It's such an obvious question that we never ask. You know?
Yeah, I have.
I
asked
that one, but yeah, there's
not every time, I'm sure. But,
sure. Yeah, that's true. I'm not perfect, believe it or not. But
wow.
Yeah, I think there's a. I don't know.
Fire you?
You want to fire me?
I hired you on the assumption you're perfect.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. So I found some names off of these old newsletters and memos, and because, like you said, they're people from the 70s, it's a lot of fun trying to track them down. It's a lot of like, okay, well, they're going to be in their 70s or 80s or possibly 90s. Mm-hmm. Let's start trawling the internet and see if I can find like an address that I can write them a physical letter to, and hope they respond and it's the right person. And Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's a family member letting me know that they are deceased or like too ill to talk or whatever. But
that's really nice that they respond and say that, though.
Yeah, every time I get one of those, I'm like, well, at least you told me.
Yeah.
The one was actually, for the Channel F thing, I was trying to find Suresh Vasa, who wrote the original Blackjack program for the sort of the predecessor Channel F
sort Raven, of thing. I think, right?
Not even Raven. It was like their internal F8 microprocessor like development system. He wrote a Blackjack game for it, and they ended up reusing that for the Channel F. And so I tracked down who I thought was him, and I wrote a letter, and I heard back from his daughter, who was like, well, you know, he's not really in any sort of physical condition to do an interview, but he's really glad someone is interested. And I'm like, oh, that's very sweet.
That is very nice. Hey, I like that.
So they got a little thank in the credits for this video.
Okay.
There's some folks I'd love to talk to for this. Like, I'd love to talk to Jerry Thacker, who was like a contractor they hired to do some games. And like, who on earth outside of Fairchild knew how to program for the F8 microprocessor in 1976? Like, I gotta know what's up with that. But
I imagine part of your process is whenever you talk to someone, you just give them the list. It's like, do you know any of these people still? Right.
Some usually they don't, but sometimes they do. Like Rich Olney, when I talk to him, he's like, oh, yeah, I'm still in touch with some of these guys. I'll reach out to them.
That's always really fun when you find someone who is like, they worked together in like 1981 and they're still in touch. I'm like, that's cool. Good for you.
My favorite part is they wouldn't talk to me, but they would talk to him. So I just sent him some questions and he sent them to them.
All right. Any final thoughts on the Channel F before we wrap this up?
It's a really neat little system. As far as I know, emulation for it's pretty decent. So you can try it out with a much less janky controller at some point.
Play it on an Xbox One controller.
Experience, though.
The controller is part of the experience, but
Do many games use the sort of paddle part, the rotating?
A shocking number do.
Okay, so a little difficult, actually.
But, you know, if you think about it, it's just all the same functionality as like an NES controller, like the rotation is sort of like the select and start buttons. The push and pull is the A and B buttons. So like, it's not something you couldn't map to a normal controller.
And there's probably not a lot of twitchy rotation. You're not playing like Mad Planets or something on it.
Right, right. Like when it's coming up, it's usually, it's for like a hockey game to rotate your goalie and that
Got
kind of
it.
Thing.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for your work, for putting out a documentary on the Channel F when no one else would, for braving those waters, and for joining us today on the Video Game History Hour. We will link, of course, to this video, to the Atari Archive YouTube channel where it is, and your Twitter and such. But for those listening, where can we find you on the internet?
So I am on Twitter at Ubersaurus. I am on Patreon at Atari Archive, and I'm on YouTube under Atari Archive as well. And my website is atariarchive.org, not to be confused with atariarchives.org, which I didn't realize was a thing until after I registered the domain.
Oops.
Oh, well.
All right. Thanks again, Kevin.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter at Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunimune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.